Hello, I'm Sidra Stone.
And I'm Hal Stone.
We'd like to welcome you to the Mendocino series of voice dialogue tapes, in which we will be presenting our work on the many selves. We've been living in Mendocino County for some time now, and all of our writing has been done in our home on the headlands. It's a foggy, mystical place from which we can see and hear the ocean. We've spent many happy hours walking, and many of our ideas are worked out on these walks. We wanted this tape series to recreate some of the informality and excitement that we feel as we walk and talk with each other along the Mendocino roads. And that's why we named this the Mendocino series. This, our first tape, is called Meeting Yourselves, and it begins at the beginning with an introduction to the psychology of the selves.
We wanted to start this series with a story. It's a story, actually, that was written up in our book, but we wanted to tell it in this tape because it's so significant in terms of understanding the psychology of selves. The story begins with a mother tiger who's very, very pregnant, who's about to deliver her very young cub. And as she wanders through the forest, she comes upon a herd of goats, and she goes chasing after the goats. And she chases and chases, and finally she kills one of the goats. And at that point, since she's in a very advanced pregnancy, the chase didn't agree with her very much, and she dies. But the baby tiger is born. And this little baby tiger is born amidst this herd of goats who, once the mother tiger is no longer there, they come back to the place, and they adopt this this little tiger. And this little tiger is raised amidst this group of goats, and it baas like a goat, and it smells like a goat, and it acts like a goat, it walks like a goat. And nobody knows that it's a tiger, because who would know that? Anyhow, many years pass, and this tiger grows up into, a young adulthood. And it's really a strange sight to see it playing with the goats and baaing and so forth. But one day, going through the forest, is an older tiger, and he gets the smell of this goat herd, and he goes chasing, and all the goats run away. But the tiger goat, of course, doesn't run away. He just stands there, and he looks very curiously at this tiger because he's not afraid at all. Well, this male tiger, you can imagine, when it walks up to this tiger goat and smells it, and he smells goat, and he takes his paw and he smacks it in the face, and it goes, rah, and baas like a goat. I mean, he's horrified at this, and he drags this tiger goat to the water, and he shoves its face next to the water, you know, to say, look at your face. You know, you're not a goat, you're a tiger. And this tiger goat doesn't understand it. He just doesn't, he can't make sense out of the whole thing. And then the older tiger goes after a piece of meat from the goat that it's killed, and he brings this piece of meat over, and he shoves it in the mouth of this tiger goat. Well, at first he's, horrified, eating one of his brothers. But he forces him to chew it, and then he takes another piece of meat and shoves it in his mouth, and pretty soon he gets the taste of the flesh and the blood and the meat, and he starts to chew, and he really loves it, and suddenly he lets out a roar, his own roar of awakening to the realization that he really is a tiger, and the two of them go off running into the forest.
It's a great story. And it really gives us a wonderful picture of the development of personality, because our little tiger in his ultimate vulnerability has really developed a set of primary selves to enable him to live with the goats, right?
Right.
So he had to learn how to talk like a goat and walk like a goat and to pretend he wasn't a tiger. And sooner or later, he just forgot all about the tiger that he was born as.
It's strange because in some way, it's almost as though this story is a description of the way all of us are raised. Because at some level, we have a natural self, which we'll be talking about soon. And that natural self has superimposed upon it many, many, many other kinds of selves that take over and help us to live life. And part of the whole journey that we're going to be talking about in this series is how do we learn about these different selves that have taken over and run our life, and mm-hmm. how do we make peace with them, and how do we find the people on the other side who represent more natural ways of living without doing an injustice to the original people that took care of us.
Right. And because each of us, just like our little tiger was born as a tiger, each of us is born unique. Each of us is born with what you and I have decided is a psychic fingerprint. It's something that we can be recognized by, almost like a melody or a vibration that characterizes us. You know, a mother, when she's carrying a baby, can actually recognize that baby after it's been born, because each one has a sort of a feel to it when it's in the womb, and it's recognizable when it comes out.
Some people refer to that as the essential self.
That's right, or the authentic self.
Or the authentic self. I like psychic fingerprint in a way, because if you use the term authentic self, it's almost immediately a judgment on the other selves.
Right, and these other selves are selves that have developed to really help us.
Right.
For instance, that little tiger baby couldn't live to be a tiger in a goat herd, just as we can't live to be our unique psychic fingerprint. We can't live out our unique psychic fingerprint as little kids. We need to develop a certain set of primary selves to enable us to get along in our family, in our community, in our church, in our nation. And if we don't develop these selves to protect us, we're too vulnerable and we'll just become victims to everybody.
When you use the word, then, primary selves, exactly what do you mean by it? I think it's important for our audience to understand the sort of definition of primary self and what it is you mean by it when you use the term.
Well, a primary self is really a subpersonality that's developed to protect the vulnerable child within. That vulnerable child that carries our psychic fingerprint is kind of a doorway to the soul and is ultimately open and vulnerable to everything that goes on around. It's that child also that enables us to become intimate with other people. So a primary self is a self that comes in very early on, looks around, and tries to help us in our adjustment. The first one might be a kind of a protective self. We would like to call it, remember, a protector controller.
And in the book, Embracing Ourselves, you talk a lot about protector controller. Mm-hmm. And now you're using the different language. You're using the language now of primary self.
Right.
Could you just share with the audience how that's come about?
Well, we changed our thinking a little bit. The protector controller is actually the part of us that comes in and makes the rules, but it's a little formal, a concept. Actually, it does act as a protective part for us, and it controls our behavior. And we think of it now more or less as a rule maker or the head of the group of primary selves. But the primary selves are a group that come in to protect us. Let's get an idea of what some of them can look like, for instance. One would be really a protective voice, one that says, hey, you know, you've got to keep your mouth shut. You have to be real careful about what you say in this world. Don't just be open to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just blab what comes into your mind as soon as you see somebody, what comes into your heart. Take a good look at who you're talking to. Are they
right.
Safe? Are they not safe? So that would be one protective voice, for instance, that
then
would be protecting
us. Then there's the one that's nice that says, be nice to everybody.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah, because if you're nice to people, then they're going to be nice to you, and nobody makes waves, and nobody gets angry at you. So that would be an important primary self.
That's a real
also.
Important one, and that might sound something like this. We would call it the pleaser, but you can name him anything you want. I mean, Ethel will do, for goodness sakes. But anyway...
That was my mother's name.
Was she a pleaser?
As a matter of fact, she was, yes.
Okay, great. So anyway, our pleaser Ethel might say something like, hey, you know, I really like people. I like them. I want them to like me. I could feel how they feel, and I just feel better if they're feeling happy. I like it when they smile. I know if I make them happy, they're going to be happy to be with me and they're going to love me. So I spend a lot of time feeling into people and, you know, and seeing what they're like. And because I do that, I keep Sidra safe.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. One reads a lot today and hears a lot today in the field of codependency and that kind of writing. One hears a lot about the term false selves.
Mm-hmm.
Or the inauthentic selves, that we grow up with these false selves in charge of the personality, and then we have to learn to sort of get rid of them. Would you comment on that, the use of this term false selves and how that fits into what you're talking about?
Well, we see these primary selves as real selves. I mean, they're real people. I mean, that pleaser Ethel who just talked really cares about people. The other one, the protective one that says, hey, watch out what you're saying, watch out what you do. That's a real self. It's a real inside person. And they may not be that psychic fingerprint, but they're as much a part of somebody as any of the other selves. So we feel like it's pretty important to honor these and to be sure that they're not thrown out. You know, they're like parents that have taken care of us our whole lives, and they've done the best they can do. And I feel that we have to pay attention to that. You know, think about some of those other selves that take care of us. There's a pusher who pushes us, right?
Yes. And I know it well.
You know well, yeah. We're real good at those. And that's the one that says, oh, come on, it'll just take a minute to do this. And you can fit that in before you go. It's great with us when we're ready to go on a trip, right?
Right. That's the one that took over this morning and wanted us to get out of the house and packed and so forth mm-hmm. and be ready by 6 a.m. or something like that.
Right.
Yes, I know it well.
Right. So that's the kind that many of us have. After all, how many of us would get anything done if we didn't have a pusher pushing us a little bit? So I hate to think of that as a false self. It may
right,
not be the best
right.
self. It might drive us into a heart attack. But it's yeah. important to know that that's important, too.
So really, in a way, what you're saying, and it's basic to both of our theories, is that we don't judge any energy.
No.
We never judge. Every self is a certain kind of energy, and it has a right to exist. And our job is to learn about them and become aware of them and learn how to use them properly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different way of looking at
these selves.
Right.
We don't divide them up into good selves and bad selves and selves you have to get rid of, because any of them is here really to help us one way or another.
So what are some of the other heavyweights in the primary self system?
Well, we've got this pusher we talked about, the pleaser. Oh, the perfectionist is wonderful. The perfectionist that decides you have to be absolutely, totally perfect in everything you do. And of course, when the perfectionist is working, it's hoping that if it makes you perfect, nobody's going to be able to say anything bad about you and they'll love you.
Right.
You know, bottom line on all of them, isn't it that somebody's going to love us if we do what they say, if we do what the self says?
Or at least either we get love or at least we get protection.
Right.
Because at the deepest level, they don't want to see us hurt. They don't want to see us hurt physically, and they don't want to see us hurt emotionally and psychologically. So they'll do anything they can to protect us. If we're perfect, then people won't laugh at us. We won't make a fool out of ourselves.
Right.
People will not be able to get a hold of us in some way.
That's right. There's no way for them to get in if you're perfect.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what they do, it's funny, what they wind up doing is they bury that vulnerable child or that authentic self. They're in such a hurry to protect it and to keep it safe that they absolutely bury it.
It's a paradox in a way, isn't it? Because here we have this authentic self, or as we talk about it, this psychic fingerprint,
child.
The essential self. And in a sense, in the development of personality, if you don't develop these strong primary selves, you really can't make it in the world. Because if one remains identified with vulnerability, there's no way that you can support yourself in the world.
Absolutely.
Our society isn't built up to be able to handle that. So you've got to become, quote, strong, unquote, and make it. So these primary selves are essential, and yet on the other side is this tragedy that they totally bury the vulnerability
system. That vulnerable
system.
Child.
Right.
They bury the vulnerable child and they stand between that child and other people. It's really a paradox. We need our primary selves, and yet we need to wake up from being our primary selves. It's like waking up from a dream, like that
right.
little tiger baby waking up and knowing, hey, I'm not a goat anymore. I'm really a tiger.
Right. The other day I heard you quote the Indian story. I think that's so appropriate here.
Oh, I love that. The Native American story about we start out on our earth walk at a point, and we walk in a spiral slowly away, further and further away from who it was we were when we came in. And then at some point in our life journey, in our life walk, we wake up and we start going backwards. We reverse our direction as our search is for consciousness, and we go back along the spiral. We retrace our steps. We separate, in our terms, from our primary selves, loving them, honoring them, keeping what they have to give us, but separating from them and knowing we're not them. And we move back along the spiral closer and closer to who we are.
It's a beautiful story.
I love it. And the who we are is really making contact again with that vulnerable inner child, which carries our psychic fingerprint. Mm-hmm. But along the way, we meet lots of non-primary selves.
The non-primary selves are a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun to play with because we call those the disowned selves, or the unconscious selves, or the less developed selves. But we're going to refer to them basically as the disowned selves.
Yeah, the unconscious and the undeveloped selves are really just the ones that we haven't had a chance to develop over a lifetime.
Right. It is an important difference. For example, if somebody 20 years old is not concerned about dying, we wouldn't think about that as a disowned self, because at the age of 20, who thinks about dying? If that same person was 90 and refused to think about death, then we would be dealing with a disowned self. So a disowned self means that something is unconsciously being kept away or repressed, and that's the real meaning of it. It's quite different. So what are the disowned selves? Well, disowned selves are really the other side of primary selves. In the growing up process, you've described beautifully the way these primary selves develop. So if we develop a primary self that has to do with being powerful in the world, being responsible in the world,
then on the other side, we have to have the part that's weak.
Exactly. Weak, vulnerable.
Scared of the world.
Scared of the world, shy, lazy, not wanting to work. Actually, it would be a whole system of selves on the other side. The degree to which we are identified with the primary selves is exactly the degree to which we will disown on the other side the equal and the opposite energy in an equal and opposite way. Mm-hmm. It behaves very mathematically. So if you identify with power, and that's the primary self, to the 13th power, on the other side will be vulnerability to the 13th power.
It's wonderful. It's absolutely basic physics. I remember that from Physics 1. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Right. And once you really understand this principle of the psyche, a lot of things become very, very clear, because there are very serious consequences to this disowning process. So the disowned selves always develop in relationship to the primary selves. The more we identify with these different primary selves, the more disowned selves are on the other side. Now, there is a very fundamental principle here that is very important, because we ask the question, how can you discover your disowned selves? I mean, if you could discover your disowned selves, that would be wonderful, because your ability to become a conscious human being would change very rapidly.
Because it's really hard unless you have a big tiger coming in and grabbing you by the neck and shaking you and saying, hey, lady, you're a tiger, you're not a goat.
That's right.
Jung, you have no way of knowing your primary selves.
Yeah. Jung used to say that the trouble was that the unconscious is really unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
That's very true. What is unconscious is unconscious. You can't know about it. At this moment, I may know certain things about myself, but I can't know what's unconscious in me. It's just by definition. But there are ways to discover what your disowned selves are.
I like these.
And the fundamental principle, which we, of course, always use in our workshops, the fundamental principle is, who is it in your life that you can't stand? What kind of person is it who really pushes your buttons? Who do you judge? Who do you hate? The more extreme the judgment, the more extreme the negative emotion that you have to another person, the more that person carries the disowned self. For example, let's say that we have a man who is a very, very powerful, responsible kind of person. He has a business and he's very successful. He has employees. He is responsible to his business. He is responsible to his family. He takes this kind of thing very, very seriously. So his primary selves are the responsible father. The primary selves are power. The primary selves are perfectionism. The primary selves have to do with money and ambition and making money. And he has disowned, then, on the other side, the part of him that is vulnerable, the part of him that was awkward and shy, the part of him that has any kind of fear of the world, the part of him that is a sort of Hawaiian beach bum. I mean, all of those mm-hmm. would be disowned energies. So in this particular case, the person that he can't stand is his oldest son. His son is somebody who is identified with all of his disowned selves. The son is lazy, the son is not ambitious, the son doesn't want to make a lot of money, the son is everything that is opposite to his primary selves. And the years pass, and he is constantly in conflict with this son. Now, the law of the psyche is that whatever it is in your life that you disown, life will bring you back. Every disowned self is like one of God's little heat-seeking missiles. If you disown your vulnerability, then life will bring you vulnerability through your son, through an employee, through your wife, through your dog. It will bring it to you in some way and cause you enormous aggravation and grief until you recognize it as a disowned self. And unfortunately, as parents, it's something we have to deal with all the time, because these disowned selves often are lived out through our children.
It's almost invariable that children carry some of our disowned selves. It's kind of fun in the workshops when we ask about disowned selves.
Right, right.
And we get these pairs. It's always this heat-seeking missile quality. You know, you have a very, very loving, giving, psychologically understanding mother who absolutely adores her child.
Perfect.
And just takes the greatest care to raise that child, to see to its every need, to be sure that it knows that it lives in a safe universe, et cetera, et cetera. And the child is just as likely to grow up pushing off of the mother, carrying all of the mother's disowned selves, being selfish, unconcerned about other people, not caring at all what people think, and being really not very nice about feelings. Another great pair that often happens is when you've got a very neat mother, a very perfectionistic neat mother. I mean, every perfectionistic neat mother absolutely needs a sloppy child.
Right.
It's a rule of the psyche, I think.
Yeah, or a very rational, intellectual man who gets involved with a woman who is very spiritual, and then he constantly is judging her and fighting her because she is too spiritual and too soft-headed and too intuitive and constantly, constantly judging. I remember hearing about a situation once where this went on for 2 years. And the relationship finally broke up, and within 6 weeks he was involved with another woman who was the exact same spiritual type from the exact same spiritual organization as the woman he'd been with for 2 years.
I love it.
So it's like we are led inexorably into many relationships by our disowned selves.
It's interesting. It has an almost a metaphysical quality to it.
It does.
That there's something that we're missing and that God is sending to us, that the universe is providing us with the missing piece. Women, you know, so often I talk to women who have really made it in the world. They've gotten real powerful and they're together and they're focused and they can get their jobs done and take care of themselves and be independent. And they invariably have the complaint that the men they draw in are kind of weak and vulnerable and not very motivated and a little bit too flowing.
Right.
And what are they supposed to do about them?
Right. Do you remember the two women at the workshop that came to you that were like that?
Mm-hmm, and I just giggled.
Their boyfriends,
their boyfriends were pot smokers.
Right. And they wondered why that kept happening to them.
Yeah, they kept saying, we have this addictive relationship to pot smokers and to these laid-back guys. And, of course, it was their disowned selves appearing over and over and over again. Obviously, the women didn't have any connection to the part of themselves that could, you know, sit back on a Sunday, smoke dope, and just kind of look at the grass grow.
Right. Another example you see very commonly is somebody who's a very loving person who's been particularly trained in sort of a New Age loving way, and they disown their hardness. They disown their instinctuality or their demonic energies,
mm-hmm.
and they get involved with a man who carries a very harsh, aggressive, cutting kind of energy,
mm-hmm.
and everybody looks at them and wonders how the two of them ever got together. But they got together because the law of the universe gives her this opportunity. The interesting thing is that these disowned selves cause enormous aggravation. I mean, they really are the basis of stress, of real stress in relationships.
That's true, between partners or parents
exactly.
and children.
And if we can take the step of moving back from these relationships and really beginning to sense that the relationship is really a teacher,
yeah.
I think that it makes a lot of difference. The other thing with disowned selves is that it isn't always negative. For example, if you know somebody and they carry positive features,
mm-hmm.
and
they're absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, they're so creative and you feel like nothing, or they're so spiritual and you feel like nothing,
or they're so glamorous or wise
right.
or beautiful.
Right, exactly.
Together,
exactly. The same principle applies, so that you can judge somebody or you can overvalue someone. In either case, you have the possibility of discovering one of the disowned selves. So let's say a young woman in college who dresses in a very ordinary way, and she has a boyfriend, and she's always jealous of glamorous kinds of girls at school who spend a lot of money on clothing and dress to the hilt and a lot of makeup. because that kind of person really creates a lot of jealousy in them.
Makes her feel, say, inadequate.
Right.
And
right.
Not knowing how to present herself in the same
right.
way. So that, too, would be a disowned self.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it?
Right. Or somebody who meets a teacher who's very wise and thinks that teacher is so wonderful. That's the teacher also is carrying the disowned selves, and that's really how we learn a lot about ourselves, by finding teachers and therapists who carry our disowned selves. Except it's nice to know that they're carrying our disowned selves, so we learn to get them back. And
that's right.
Don't need teachers and therapists forever.
Because that's really part of the journey, right?
Right.
It's part of that return on the spiral, is we're collecting the selves that we discarded over the journey of life along the way.
Right.
So we're really collecting back those disowned selves and separating from the primary selves that we have been.
Right. So now we come to this issue. We have these primary selves and we have these disowned selves, and really it's extremely valuable to be able to look at them and create some kind of map of the psyche.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually brings up a very important point we have to underline, and that is that the primary selves that we've been identified with, the ones that have been taking care of us our whole lives, are very threatened by our disowned selves. They're very frightened by them. And they're afraid that if we pick them up on this journey of consciousness, that we're going to be less safe or less lovable. Because their job has been to keep these disowned selves away, because that seemed like the best road to take. So in starting to uncover the disowned selves and to separate from the primary selves, what we all have to realize is we're not going to become the disowned self. I mean, the adequate, substantial businessman or businesswoman is not going to become a beach bum. We're not saying you become the opposite. We're just saying that you bring the disowned energies in. You start learning about them, seeing what it is that you've dropped along the way, and just integrate some of that music into your overall symphony. It doesn't have to be the main theme, but just be able to integrate some of that.
So this is why really people are so frightened so often of the whole consciousness journey, and why they're so frightened of dealing with disowned material, because that primary self that they're identified with goes into a kind of contraction.
Mm-hmm. Says, oh my goodness, I don't want her to become like that, or I don't want him to get like that. Everything's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you handle that then in working with people in the disowned selves? I mean, how do you help the primary self not be terrified?
Oh, well, we'll be talking about that in our voice dialogue tapes, but basically it's seriously honoring the primary selves, talking to them, getting their concerns down pat, you know, really knowing what their concerns are, knowing what they're worried about, and letting them know you appreciate them for how far they've taken you on this particular life walk.
So really then, it's this respect for the primary selves that's really the safeguard, and they know then that they don't have to go any place they don't want to go.
That's right.
And they then become more willing to open to the disowned self system.
That's right.
Well, if I were a primary self, I'd be very happy about that, and I'd be very happy to open up to you anytime. I just
Gee,
want you to
thanks.
Know that.
Oh, you're a nice fella.
Good.
We thought we'd give you some more examples of primary and disowned selves and the way they interact, because it's so important to get a picture of these in the understanding of one's own psyche. One of the examples I was thinking of, Hal, was that one of a mother and a daughter who came to one of our workshops, and they came up to talk to us afterwards, and the mother was saying that when she and the daughter go on a drive on a freeway, that somehow she becomes a bumbling idiot and her daughter becomes terribly well organized and becomes a navigator, really knows where to go. And they polarize. They get more and more opposite. The daughter gets irritated with her as the mother gets more and more bumbling, and the mother gets...
They drive themselves into the opposite.
Absolutely drive themselves into the opposite. That's what we always see with these disowned selves.
That reminds me of us at the dinner table. You with your primary self of a New York proper lady, and me with my California laid-back psychology, and... And then what we get into sometimes, particularly when the children are around and they're more identified with New York proper, and I suddenly go into this clumsy oaf who has food on his hair and on his toes and on his shirt, and you'd think that I was 2 years old.
And I get neater and neater and more judgmental.
Right, right. That's always an interesting. These disowned selves and primary selves really are best seen relationally, it would appear, aren't they? Because it seems like to really understand them, you have to catch them as they operate in relationship to another
person
where they live.
That's right, because it's someplace else where we see our disowned selves. We don't see it in ourself.
Right,
we see
right.
it in the other person. And the other thing to remember is that they change. They change with the situation. Our primary selves, surprisingly enough, can shift from situation to situation. For instance, that mother and daughter I was talking about, at the end of their describing these terrible tiffs they have on their freeway forays, mm-hmm. at the end of that, the mother looked at me and she said, "You know, the funny thing is, when I drive by myself, I never get lost. I never get mixed up."
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, how often we hear that. You reminded me of another workshop we did where this lovely professional man came up to me and just begged to understand his relationship to his girlfriend because he loved her and he was a very intuitive, flowing, new age kind of person that just poured out love and vulnerability. And she was, of course, his total opposite. She was impersonal where he was personal. She was withdrawn where he was and introverted, where he was extroverted. She was English, the epitome of the impersonal English woman. Yeah. And he was, of course, the California, not hippie, but he had all of that kind of flowing energy. And how terribly he suffered in that relationship, and how terribly she suffered in that relationship, because they both couldn't understand what was happening between them because they loved each other and they wanted it to work. And when he finally got this insight that he totally disowned his impersonal, the impersonal physician that had gotten him through medical school and residency, he'd lost it totally in his consciousness journey. It was like getting out of prison to really have a realization of that disowned self. And I think it's important also to understand that as we begin to get awareness of these primary selves and disowned selves, begin to map them, which we'll be talking about soon, how to do that, that the mapping of the psyche is like getting an aerial view of the land. You then have to explore the jungle. You then have to get down to the ground and do the actual work that's necessary to claim these disowned selves.
That's right, to separate from the primary selves claim the disowned ones.
I would hate people to have the impression that suddenly if you discover your disowned self by this kind of exercise, that suddenly you have it available to you. It does happen sometimes, but usually it takes, you know, real work in order to claim these selves.
Well, like, for instance, if I were a woman who had never developed my business side.
Right.
And I realized that I really hated businesswomen, all those efficient, officious ladies who walked around quite properly carrying their briefcases and knowing which end was up, and that I judged them terrifically for that, and that I've disowned the business part of me that knows how to do all that. Well, just because I find out that I've disowned it doesn't mean it's going to appear magically. I may have to take some courses in business, you know, and how to whatever, how to do my investments and how to balance a checkbook and how to take care of all the details of an ongoing business.
It seems as though once you have available to you the disowned self and the primary self, you begin to have choice. That as long as you're identified with a primary self system, you have no choice. If you're identified with power and intellectuality and ambition and so forth, then everything that you choose in life isn't really a choice. It's like those primary selves choose you. You are chosen by those selves.
And you have no way of picking an opposite stance in any area of your life whatsoever. I like the way we talk about the ballots. I don't know if other parts of the country get ballots like the Californians do, but every election we get these big fat booklets that describe the pro and the con on each issue that we have to vote. And we read them. And if you read the pro, it's absolutely clear that's the way you should go.
Right.
And if you never look over to the other side and read the con, then you vote absolutely concisely and positively, and you know you've done the right thing. The problem is if you go to the other side and you read the con, you read the opposite, the opposing argument, then you have choice and you also have the burden of making a choice.
Right, right.
It's harder. I was thinking about, we had this wonderful example of a fellow in Australia. Again, he was a really good guy. He was very much dedicated to furthering the interests of world peace. He was a very conscious person. He was very supportive of the entire consciousness community in his area of Australia. And he totally disowned everything about him that was negative, that was not nice, that was manipulative, that would take advantage of other people. And of course, what did he bring in his life was a really dishonest business partner. And this caused him a tremendous amount of pain and discomfort, and it also cost him some money. And he finally got rid of the business partner in his business. But as things will happen, he couldn't get rid of him in his dreams. He couldn't get rid of him in his unconscious. This was a disowned self that wanted to be integrated. And he dreamt this wonderful dream of this man, this business partner, this dishonest business partner, that he had died, but that his body was lying in his living room, and he could not get rid of the body in the middle of his living room, do what he may. He tried to pull him out. He tried to chop him up and get rid of him. He tried to pour acid on him, but that body just lay there, and there was no way he could get rid of him, dead or alive. So it was a beautiful example, I think, of, you know, how the dreams will insist on our taking a look at a disowned self, even if we don't want to in real life.
It's also a beautiful example of the basic premise that we operate under in all of our work, and that is that you don't get rid of anything. The journey of personality development is not a neurosurgical journey. We do not chop out parts. We do not get rid of things that we think are bad. Because whoever it is that wants to get rid of something in the psyche is always a primary self trying to get rid of the other side, or it's a disowned self trying to get rid of the primary self.
Mm-hmm.
Our job is really to be able to embrace both sides and not get rid of anything and learn how to handle all of them, which is a tall order. But the dream reminded me also of how important the dream process really is in working with the psychology of selves. Because the dreams so often bring to us our disowned selves and our primary selves. It's like our disowned right. selves call out to us in the nighttime, I'm here, pay attention to me, look at me, don't avoid me. And the more that we ignore the disowned self, the stronger they get. So if a woman disowns her instinctuality and she disowns her power, she always is identified with being nice and pleasing, and she dreams that a black man is trying to rape her, or wild animals are stalking in her backyard, or she's driving in a car and Mexican adolescents are trying to molest her in some way. This black man and the wild animals and the aggressive Mexican youth are all parts of her own self. Her own disowned self system, that are really crying out to her for redemption. They're saying, if you don't pay attention to me, we are going to get stronger and stronger, and we are going to attack you, and we are going to hate you. And what happens then is that with instinctual energies, when they're disowned over time, they become demonic. They begin to work against us and hurt us in ways that can be very dangerous to us. They can cause serious illness on a physical level.
They can cause us to do apparently foolish things that are totally out of character, like getting involved with people that are not good for us or
exactly.
not nice.
Right, exactly.
And getting involved in an almost addictive way with people who aren't nice, if we're always identified with being nice.
Well, that's a good word to use, because people talk about addictive relationships and fatal attractions in relationships. The addictive relationships of our lives, the fatal attractions of our lives, are what? They're relationships in which our disowned selves are very extreme, and so we're pulled in the relationship to the person who carries that disowned self.
Right, and if we don't integrate it, we can't get rid of it. It's like Brer Rabbit with a tar baby. He couldn't get rid of it. He couldn't throw it away. It just stuck to his fingers.
Right. I remember a very funny example in England. This young woman, she was in our workshop, and she had a dream that a very ugly Arab had come to her door and wanted to go out on a date. Now, she was a very proper lady, very much identified with doing things the right way and very much cut off from her instinctual life. And the Arab would have represented someone who was very, very different than her whole way of being. She was also Jewish, and so he would represent an opposite that way. But in the dream, he wanted to go out on a date with her, and she was just horrified at the thought. And very often, our disowned selves come up in dreams as ugly people or ugly things.
Mm-hmm. Or frightening things.
Yeah, they're ugly, and they're very ugly and very frightening because they've been disowned over time. But in the dream, she refuses to go out with him, and then he urinates all over her. And
I
she's, of course, horrified.
He basically pisses on her.
Right. And the disowned selves are like that. If you don't pay attention to the disowned selves, then they piss on you, and the consequences of that can be very serious.
Or they grow bigger and more ferocious. Actually, in that same English workshop, we had a woman, I remember, who had dreamt that she was trying to stuff this sweet white Persian kitten into a Volkswagen. And as she was trying to stuff it in, it was getting bigger and bigger, and it turned into a tiger that was mauling her and fighting her and not wanting to be shoved into this Volkswagen and constricted. Right. And when we thought about it, and she thought about it, it was really her Aphrodite nature. It was just a very lovely, sensual vibration that she had cut off many, many years earlier and tried to tuck away.
Right.
And it turned into a tigress.
These dreams are so interesting because it's like they set off a chain of associations. Of course, we've seen thousands of dreams, and they're all in our head. But I remember two dreams. One was the minister that we wrote up in the book that had been quite repressed and very much disowning his natural instinctual energies. And he dreams that he's trying to wrestle a drunk penis into a cold shower. It's a beauty because, you know, the penis wasn't drunk to begin with. It's just a penis.
That tiger was a little kitten.
Exactly. And after, you know, decades of disowning, that penis is now drunk and out of control and ultimately would have gotten him into very serious trouble because that behavior would have manifested in some way, would have broken out in some way because you can't maintain disowned selves.
Oh, you know what I was thinking of? The opposite. You know, when you dream of the police coming after you, when you've gotten too out of control, I was thinking that we're moving more on the instinctual side.
That's a good one. Good example.
But when we've gotten too disorganized and too laissez-faire or too identified with our instincts, very frequently we'll dream that the police are chasing us or the principal of the school wants an accounting from us something like that. One of the more structured people of the world is coming after us and wanting us to straighten up and fly right.
Good example. The one other example I loved is the dream of the woman who is trying to wrestle a 50-foot python into a box, and she's not being very successful. Every energy is just that. It's an energy. When you disown an energy, it takes energy from the primary self to keep the disowned energy disowned. After a while, if there's enough disowned energies and if they're disowned deeply enough, it exhausts the psychophysiology. Mm-hmm. If you try to wrestle a 50-foot python into a box and tuck it away, that is going to exhaust the system. And at some point, the system will break down because no one can continue to do that over too long a period of time.
So you mean by that maybe even a physical breakdown of illness if there's too much of a
disowned selves are very expensive. They're expensive financially because they cost us a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They're expensive energetically because they cost us a lot of energy. And they're expensive from a health standpoint because they're responsible for a great many illnesses. It's the basis of a lot of physical illness, in my view. But we might talk a little bit about the mapping of the psyche and how we do this, what the meaning of this mapping is.
Yeah, as you were saying, you know, what we're doing is really getting an aerial picture when we map. We can get an aerial picture of ourselves, the disowned ones and the primary ones. And as we were saying earlier, the way to get a fix on our primary selves is to see what is the disowned self that upsets me or that intrigues me, and then to track back and see what's the primary self I'm identified with. So we can actually map the psyche either in an intellectual fashion, you know, just getting a picture in our heads. Well, you know, I am identified with, say, my pusher and my pleaser and my hard worker and my good girl. And on the other side, I disown my lazy part or my soft part or my inadequate part.
So it's really what you're describing then is an extrapolation process that we can't get to the primary selves. That's too hard to figure out. But if we can get to the disowned selves through this kind of exercise, then we can figure out what's on the other side.
Exactly. And then we get a picture of where we are sitting in the middle of these selves, the disowned selves that are off to the side or hidden or behind us, and the primary selves that are standing round and protecting us in the world and presenting our persona or who we are.
Now, when you talk about diagramming, do you mean literally diagramming?
Well, you can actually make a literal diagram with a seat for yourself or a big circle for yourself in the middle, and then draw different color circles or size circles or intensity of circles representing the various selves in their positions around you. Some people have found that really helpful. Mm-hmm. Others have actually drawn little faces or little figures for the different selves, labeled them and said, well, this is my, you know, this is my protector and this is my playful child and this is my magical child and this is my responsible mother and this is my irresponsible mother. And they actually draw pictures. Others like to do collages, actually pick out pictures in a magazine and maybe make a collage and pick out pictures that represent the various selves. Actually, my favorite was a Christmas card we got this year from somebody who sent a Christmas card. She had this wonderful set of graphics done by a friend who actually pictured all herself. She sent greetings from about 12 different selves and then wound up with herself as the aware ego, which actually brings us to the point of what is consciousness and what is, you know, now that we have a picture of the disowned selves and of the primary selves, what do we do with it?
Well, I think this is really a very important part of the whole picture, and that is, you know, what do we mean by consciousness? Because it's defined in so many different ways by so many people, and we do have an approach to it, I think, that's somewhat unique. So our way of looking at consciousness is that it involves three different levels of activity or behavior or thought. Level number one is the level of awareness. Now, awareness is really quite fantastic. It gives you the ability to step back and witness whatever's going on.
That's kind of what the meditators use all
right,
the time,
right?
Right,
it's really the goal of meditation is to be able to be in a witness state and observe what's going on. Awareness is not an action state. You don't act from awareness. You simply witness from awareness.
You don't judge or fix or make
exactly.
plans for how
right.
to improve.
It's also not attached to the outcome of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that in the awareness level, you may be aware of a primary self and a disowned self. You may be aware of the power side, and you may be aware of the vulnerability. But you don't say that one's better than the other. You're not attached to the behavior at all.
You just kind of look at the size and the shape and the power
right.
and the energies.
Attachment is the key thing.
Mm-hmm.
In pure awareness, there's no attachment whatsoever. So
mm-hmm.
it's a wonderful state because it gives us the ability to step back and witness anything. It gives us the ability to disidentify from our bodies, from our ideas, from our emotions. A very important part of consciousness.
Isn't that what some people call consciousness?
Many people, historically speaking, in the consciousness movement have defined that as consciousness.
Oh, okay.
But it really isn't the whole thing, because if you have awareness without experience, you've got a problem. The second level of the definition is experience, the experience of the different parts of yourself, the experience of your anger, the experience of your aggression, the experience of your spirituality, the experience of love, the experience of the pleaser, the experience of high states of consciousness, the experience of all kinds of body states. I mean,
actually, that's what we've been talking about, right? The experience of all these different parts.
Exactly, exactly. Because if you are just aware of anger, for example,
mm-hmm.
or aware of love, that's not sufficient, because if you haven't had the experience of them, something's missing. So now we have two elements of the definition. We have awareness and we have experience. And they're an important pair. But somebody has to come along now and regulate these two. Somebody has to learn from these two things and ultimately run the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And here we postulate the idea of an aware ego. Now, this is a very, very, I think, new idea, very revolutionary idea, and an extremely valuable one, because the aware ego replaces the old concept of ego. You know, ego has not been very popular in many, many spiritual...
Not had good press,
right,
no.
Not in spiritual circles in particular, not in the humanistic movement in many ways, because people see the different ego states as essentially negative. Spiritually oriented people see the ego as something you have to get rid of in order to get in touch with transpersonal energies. Historically speaking, the ego was the choice maker, the executive function of the psyche. What we, of course, have discovered in our work is that what people call the ego essentially is the primary self or the system of primary selves that's in charge of the personality. That is what the ego is.
And that's why that whole feeling of not having choice comes about and
exactly.
being attached and not having any
exactly.
kind of separateness.
So if I'm identified with power,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I'm identified with power.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that until you help me separate from power.
By finding your disowned self, say, of
vulnerability
on the other side.
At that point, I know about power on one side and vulnerability. I now have an ego that's more aware. Mm-hmm. So the aware ego is really a process that always goes on. And it's a process that in which this aware ego gradually separates from more and more of the primary selves, mm-hmm. becomes more and more aware of the disowned selves, and becomes a more effective aware ego.
So if we were to go back to our original image of that spiral walk, and as we return to the point at which we came in, to the psychic fingerprint of who we are, as we walk backwards, we're picking up our disowned selves, we're separating from our primary selves, and our ego is becoming more and more aware. The process is becoming more and more complete as we come closer and closer
exactly.
to the essence of who we are.
The aware ego gives us the ability to embrace opposites. The aware ego, by definition, is more accepting, more allowing, and more unconditionally loving.
Because it's got the opposites, and it's in touch with the teaching of all of these
exactly.
disowned selves around us.
People sometimes, you know, will ask us about where does love fit into your system and compassion. Well, we don't teach people to love. We don't teach people to have compassion because we know the consequence of that. If you teach people to love, then they try to be loving. If you teach people to be compassionate, they try to be compassionate. Automatically, that means they're going to disown their non-loving side.
So they identify with the primary compassionate loving selves, and they disown the irritable, uncharitable selves on the other side.
Exactly, exactly.
And would probably very much judge people who are irritable and uncharitable and not loving. And
well,
have negative thoughts.
We not only know that they're going to judge that person, we know that they're going to pull that kind of person into their lives, and that kind of person is mm-hmm. going to drive them crazy, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So from our position, it really doesn't solve anything to teach that. The idea of an aware ego that takes advantage of awareness and the experience of these selves and learns how to live with opposites and constantly is growing and changing, that automatically begins to hook us into that psychic fingerprint, to that essential being in ourself. And as that begins to happen, the loving part of our nature and the compassionate part of our nature automatically begins to cue in.
Right.
And it's, for me, a much better way to go at it because I'm not very happy about the other side of love. I'm not very happy about disowning our negativity and our negative instinctuality and so forth.
Well, it does have to go somewhere.
Right.
And on a planetary level, it has to go. If it doesn't go to our partners, our friends, our families, it has to go to our neighbors, our neighboring countries,
right.
other groups, other religious, racial groups within our own country. So we find that whole groups of people carry our disowned selves.
Exactly.
And we'll be either afraid of them or dislike them or judge them. I'd like to underline what you said again, which is that the aware ego really walks the line between the awareness and the experience of the parts. So the aware ego is able to collect information from both sides. It gets that impersonal witness information from the awareness position, and it also is able to get all the information that the selves bring with them, all of the feelings, the passion, and the experiencing of life that the selves bring with them. And it's this that it works and it moves forward with.
Right. I know that you're not happy with the analogy that I use here, but I'll give it anyhow. I can't resist. And that is the aware ego knows how to sweat properly. If I think about it personally, I think one of the highest religious acts that there is to stand still in a moment of time and embrace opposites or more than opposites.
It's so hard.
To be able to do that in life is really a very profound act because what happens when we are able to embrace opposites is that our unconscious is able to deepen its own process.
Mm-hmm.
We know what happens when we observe people who begin to embrace opposites. We see what happens to their dream process, to their meditation process. It changes totally.
And it also changes who they are. It brings them closer and closer to that essential being that they are.
Yeah. And as you have said many times, you talk about the center of gravity. I think that's very appropriate here.
Yeah, where the center of gravity gets much, much lower. If we're identified with just one half of our being, we're off balance. and we can easily be pushed over. If I'm totally emotional and only coming from an emotional space, if you present me with an intellectual argument, I have nothing to answer you with. But if I have both my intellectuality and my emotionality available to me, it's as though I'm walking through life with a very low center of gravity. I can't be pushed over by any surprises.
And the last point of all here in regard to the unconscious and the way it begins to change when we hold these opposites is the fact that it begins to bring in the inner teacher, that the unconscious begins to bring in a focus that it didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And it begins to teach us literally. It brings us messages. The imagery becomes much clearer. The meditations become much clearer. And we begin to get a handle on what an inner teacher is really about as this process moves along.
So we really are aligning ourselves more and more with our own essential being, our own unconscious, with transpersonal energies. We just are more in alignment. Our center of gravity is lower, and we move through life in a more gracious and graceful way. Sweating, perhaps.
Yes.
Well, maybe I could just say, I like it. I like the idea of dancing or juggling the different energies and
juggling,
moving forward.
Some people see the aware ego as the conductor of the orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Or the CEO of a big company, the chief executive officer who takes input from everybody around a big table and then makes his decisions or her decisions.
Right. So I think now maybe it's time to bring a kind of summary of the ideas that we've been talking about and give our audience a chance to bring some of their thoughts together.
Okay, well, we could start again with our vulnerable child. We all come in as a vulnerable child. This child never grows up. This child is what carries within it our own psychic fingerprint, the impress of who we are, essentially, whatever our essential being is. It's exquisitely sensitive to everybody in the world, and it's the part of us that's capable of intimacy. When this child is lost to us, then we can't have that feeling of being truly met by another at the depths of who we are. There's always that feeling of missing and of not quite getting what we want. So this child comes in and needs something to protect it in the world.
So now we move into the development of the primary selves. These are the parts of the personality that begin to organize themselves around this child. They try to keep things safe. They don't want the child injured physically. They don't want the child injured psychologically and emotionally. They will do anything they can to avoid pain. They may try to make the child very strong and very aggressive and assertive, or they may help the child to withdraw into a fantasy world if that's what is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
They can go in a million different directions, but literally they become the kind of parent to the personality.
Mm-hmm.
And as parents, they raise the child into adulthood, but in that process, the child, that original psychic imprint, gets lost. So usually, even before adolescence, this vulnerability begins to disappear, and with adolescence, it usually goes away solid.
Because adolescence is just too vulnerable. There's that whole recurrence of,
right,
of the feeling of being at the mercy of everybody in the world. Okay, so the next step is our disowned selves. For every primary self that gets developed in this particular way, there's an equal and opposite disowned self that gets dropped, buried, with great horror and distaste and fear.
And as part of the law of the psyche, we are constantly attracting to ourselves our disowned selves. When we are missing an energy, we know that the world is going to bring it to us in some way. The stronger the disowning, the more powerful will it be brought to us from the outer world.
Becoming aware of these primary selves and these disowned selves and mapping the psyche is a major contribution to our growth in consciousness. We separate from the primary selves, include the more and more of the disowned selves, become aware of the patterns, and are able to move with all of these contrasting and conflicting energies within us.
Right, and understanding and experiencing the psychology of selves is essential to relationship, because relationship is the dance between all of these selves.